And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, your host for today, and we're really glad you could join us for issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. You can always get great information on our websites. That's drzdrznaturally.com and naturalnurse.com, where you can download podcasts of the shows or find that information about our walks, talks, fun shops, because we don't like to work, especially when we're doing our passion, natural medicine, and the latest and the greatest on our calendar. So Natural Nurse has the day off, so I'm here, and I'm going to be interviewing one of my illustrious colleagues, and that's Dr. Karina Lopez. And a little bit about Dr. Lopez before we talk about the show. The subject's going to be homeopathy, healing the poor safely and effectively. And then I guess we could even talk about some of the interesting controversial things that have happened with homeopathy in the past couple weeks here. But Dr. Lopez is a bilingual Spanish-English naturopathic physician, homeopath, licensed acupuncturist, master herbalist, and biosynthetist. Using a supportive environment, Dr. Lopez assists with a spectrum of issues using the body's own healing potential and natural, safe, effective treatments. She began her career in conventional medical school, but that model of healthcare disillusioned her. So during this time, she became quite ill and thus learned the profound connection between health and happiness, and she was searching for new models of healthcare. She traveled to Belize, and she worked with shaman and Dr. Arvigo, I believe, and she enrolled at the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine in Bridgeport, Connecticut, as well as the School of Acupuncture and the School of Natural Healing, Dr. Christopher School of Natural Healing. She also traveled to India, where she volunteered at the Meher Baba Free Homeopathic Dispensary and practiced homeopathy under her mentor, Robert Street. And she has just excelled in homeopathic remedies. She continues an informal residency with myself where we tackle tough cases of degenerative disease, cancer, autoimmune disease, and other things using a blend of natural medicine and homeopathy. And she also attended the International Academy of Classic Homeopathy in Greece for postgraduate studies under the icon of homeopathy, George Vithoukas. And her website is Dr. Karina, that's C-A-R-I-N-A, Lopez, L-O-P-E-Z.com. Dr. Karina, how are you?
I'm great. It's so wonderful to hear from you. I'll give you just a few corrections. I actually learned from Beatrice Waite, who was the teacher of Rosita Arvigo, in regards to the actual Mayan massage, and that was, and she actually passed recently, so it's very sad for the community, but a wonderful, wonderful healer.
Great, okay.
But I'm doing great.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. So, boy, you've been on some journey, and I know you're also do a lot of juicing, and you also went down and studied at the Hippocrates Center, too, to do a lot of nature cure as well. Tell us about that.
Oh, and Wigmer Institute in Puerto Rico was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you really think about food as medicine, and Dr. Z, you having been my teacher, my, you know, doing an internship with you right now, and really thinking about something like superoxide dismutase and how important of an antioxidant that is and how much of it is in something as simple as sprouts and how beautiful in fighting real serious chronic diseases with simple foods. And you know, right now what I see in a lot of the people I see is something so simple as using Rejuvelac, which is fermented cabbage juice. And when you ferment the cabbage juice, you're getting all the enzymes, you're getting all the healthy probiotics, and then you're getting the beautiful phytoestrogenic properties of the cabbage itself and its ability to actually process estrogen. So, I mean, there's some real beautiful things manifesting with food as medicine. And at Ann Wigmore, they really emphasize detoxing, using wheatgrass, using sprouts, using fermented cabbage juices, as well as fermented wheat berries and quinoa sprouts, and really just trying to get the most from simple foods that are easily purchased. And I think that that was such a testament to what I do now in regards to really bringing back simple, simple ideas with powerful outcomes.
Yeah, and it's a program that you actually did yourself. So that's that's what I love about yourself, Karina. You kind of jump into things and do it yourself, and that's important. I really do think that, you know, I personally wouldn't go to a doctor that really hasn't tried many aspects of natural medicine itself. That's why I'm trying to really reach the next generation of people that I'm currently training right now, that you have to do these things on yourself. How can you go to a doctor and ask him about, or her, about fasting when you've never even done a fast yourself? You have no clue. It's just like I would never go to a pediatrician that doesn't have kids. They just don't understand. Until you have your own kids, you just don't get it. Believe me, I have two of them myself. And you can be the greatest, finest doctor around. That's my own personal opinion, that when you walk in the moccasins, it's the old Native American saying, walk a mile in my moccasins and then you'll know my journey. And so you'll know the journey of the patient. When you're trying to explain to them, how do I do an enema? Why should I do an enema? How do I fast? How do I sprout? How do I make delicious foods like this? What is SOT?
Right. I mean, that makes such a big deal. I mean, and even thinking about just foods themselves and thinking about cravings, you know, I heard a story recently, you know, one of my mentors, I actually studied with a raw foodist, Rio, who wrote the book Hooked on Raw, and she gave me this fascinating story about someone in her family who had a form of a skin cancer and was so, you know, the person, I believe it was apples. I want to say apples, or I can't remember the exact vegetable, but was just convinced that for some reason they had this crazy, crazy craving for this food. And they would just eat that day and night, day and night. And they were cured. Their cancer was cured. And it was so beautiful. And then recently, I've been craving string beans. And I was looking at the Chinese system of food cures and how that really manifests. And what I was craving was directly related to my health. And it was just such a beautiful joining, where you start to think about all the people who really spent time to take care of you and heal you and tell you their stories and educate you, and then it turns around. And so what am I doing? I'm going to fast on string beans.
I just think of the many generations of doctors that, from like the Emperor Shennong in 2737 BC, and how many generations of physicians there's been, which has kind of kept medicine on the straight and narrow. And that kind of segues into our topic today, because there was a physician in the 1700s named Hahnemann who unfortunately lost some family members due to heroic allopathic medicine, and was kind of left medicine and ended up kind of translating books. And when he noticed some things in certain books, he didn't agree with them. So he kind of started to try things on his own, and thus was born homeopathy. I'm sure you'll fill us in on more of the story like that, but I know that that's your specialty. And can you describe in your own words what homeopathy is and does?
You know, best way that I could think about in regards to homeopathy is a really holistic medicine. It's something that looks at all aspects of the human being, from their mind, from their body, from their physical ailments, from their past, And it really, really is able to utilize this sort of energy medicine on some level, but actually also kind of blending with the physical. I mean, you had these huge provings where they would take this herb or this animal substance and they would see how, you know, it would affect a human being in nature. And then when you find someone who actually hasn't overdosed on that substance, but actually has a similar pathology in nature, then that comes to blossom as homeopathy and using the diluted toxic substance to help heal the person who seems to be actually suffering from almost having an overdose, but never actually having that substance. So it's quite interesting. But I think it's even easier explained if you think about vaccines, where typically someone would say, okay, I don't want to get the mumps or the measles or what have you, and then we'll give them a small portion of that. But actually, homeopathy, when we think about vaccines, we actually think that's way more of a physical dose of vaccine than homeopathy even is. So homeopathy is actually even less than a vaccine would ever be, and at the same time, so curative and responsible for helping so much of the pathologies that are present in mankind when we really take the time to think about how these diseases manifest in nature and then look at the person who's naturally suffering from something without having taken that toxic substance.
So, you know, there's thank you for that. There are some other explanations of homeopathy. Like, for instance, I know I was on the program recently with Dr. Kamai on another program, and we were talking about this concept that's known in science as hormesis. And hormesis is like that certain substances have the opposite effect based on their concentration. So I'll give you an example. Right. They're looking at pesticides, and when they get super diluted and shaken down through traveling through the sewer system and banging around other molecules and whatnot until they get to be so dilute that they still have an effect. How do they know? When they give it to a plant, it acts actually as a fertilizer, not as a weed killer, or a pesticide acts to enhance the growth of bugs versus kill them. So it's kind of interesting that, like what Paracelsus said, there's no such thing as poison. Only the dose makes something a poison.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's quite a remarkable science. And, you know, in the onset of homeopathy, you know, Hahnemann's research, it was really quite intense. I mean, he would conduct these provings and, you know, apply these substances and see how the disease would manifest.
So what's a proving? What would he actually do to people?
So he would give a sort of, he would actually, they use the 6C potency to conduct provings, where they would give a homeopathic dose and to a normal person, someone who really didn't have any type of manifestations of a disease.
Right, and so they were healthy and normal folks. They didn't have any problems.
Right, they were healthy people, and then he would essentially give them the homeopathic remedy, and he would see how their normal system would become perturbed by the homeopathic remedy. And by following that and seeing what symptoms arose in the normal individual, then you would see, interestingly, the discovery of how the person with a pathology would present who is in need of that exact remedy.
So let's use the flu as an example, because we're coming up to flu season now. You know, it's getting colder out there. So let's use the flu as an example. Take us through how, like, allopathic medicine, conventional thinking, would see the flu, and contrast that with how a homeopath like yourself would see the flu, And what types of remedies would kind of fit the different flu-like presentations that patients would bring to you or come to you in your office?
Absolutely. When you see someone with the flu, first of all, if you go to a medical doctor's office, they're going to essentially prescribe you perhaps an antibiotic, even if it's viral at times, because they're afraid that something, you know, nasty might happen. And in that case, if it's something, a virus that caused the actual flu, then the antibiotic's not going to help you, and it will kind of counter your own healthy bacteria. So, you know, what's really interesting is that right now we don't have antivirals, or at least, you know, antivirals with not a ton of side effects. So the medical doctor will essentially say, okay, I'm just going to give you this remedy that I'm going to give to everyone that I see. And when they do that, they don't look at the personality of the flu and the fact that flu can be expressed in different ways for different people. So some examples would be, I'll give you a few remedies and sort of give you an idea of perhaps the differences that a homeopath would look at. So a very common remedy would be gelsemium. If you take gelsemium, you have droopy eyes, you're feeling weak and tired, you have aches, you have chills up and down your back. You know, it's for dull, droopy feelings, which I'm sure a lot of people can definitely kind of, you know, feel like they've kind of been there with the flu, you know, where you tend to feel tired. But then there are other people who may have, instead of, you know, the hot head and face and the chills, they may more have a sore throat, or they may have swollen glands, or just kind of those lingering feelings, and they may have some sensations of anger. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you may think of a remedy like Nux Vomica, especially if there is a scratchy feeling at the throat. Or let's say the person feels achy and stiff and they feel like they should, you know, get up and move and walk around, then that person might need Rhus Toxidendron. So, you know, there's different things. And in fact, I remember reading a story on James Compton Burnett, and he spoke about his early research. He's an old homeopath and very famous. And he wrote, just being a medical doctor and being in a children's clinic, and he noticed that there were these kids that would, you know, go outside and they would get this cold, dry wind. And all of a sudden, they would, you know, end up with a terrible cold, and it would just advance and advance. And he relayed this one story of these kids that were all on antibiotics, but there was one little kid that they put by a window. And when they put him by the window, a cold air hit him. And that kid ended up dying, because he was actually getting better. They moved him, but then he died by the cold wind.
Wow.
So Compton Burnett was so curious that he looked up and he said, what can I do for this child? And he found that, interestingly, when a flu is caused by a cold wind, aconite is the remedy. So he went on and he did research, and he gave all these kids different, you know, he would give them, one side would be the regular allopathic medication, and the other side of kids, he'd give aconite. And all the kids who were on aconite were doing great, and it was phenomenal. And then one day, Dr. Burnett was sick and, you know, spent the day home, and then, or went to a conference, some story like that, and the nurse gave all the children in the ward aconite. And when Compton Burnett came back, he said, wait, you know, 70% of these kids are better, and usually it's only 50%. He said, well, I was sick of your terrible, cruel test, doctor, and I gave all the kids aconite. So it was a very cute and sweet story. Wow. But the note to that is how profound these remedies are. And where he was, you know, a cold wind is what really caused these illnesses in these children that he was seeing.
Right. So I can, you know, the allopaths think that a virus causes the flu, and we've all kind of bought into this idea of the germ theory, but I guess there are mitigating factors of how that particular virus, if it is in part, you know, part of the flu, which, you know, we seem to think it's part of the pathophysiology, I would debate somebody if it's the true cause, because we in natural medicine think the cause of the disease is the predisposing factors that made you sick, because we're constantly being bombarded by microorganisms, yet we're not all sick all the time. So there has to be other mitigating factors. So is that virus really the true cause of the disease, or is it all these other mitigating factors that we look at in naturopathic medicine and these other disciplines? Or Hahnemann said, he called it, I think, the vital force or something like that, right? Is that the cause?
You know, I can really, really, you know, when we look back and we think of Louis Pasteur, you know, one of his colleagues who he was always at odds with was the famous Bichamp. And Bichamp, he really believed that our soil, that how we take care of ourselves, really is what could lay us prey to these viruses and to these bacteria. And I think that, you know, while viruses and bacteria do exist, and we've been shown that, at the same time, what I love about homeopathy, when we think of the beast, when we think of our true vitality, our constitutional makeup and our strength of who we are, and also when we think about the ability of humankind to turn around and use generations and generations of healing foods and ways to help build our systems. And I think a lot of that has been lost. And so in answering your question, I think that absolutely there's an aspect to disease, but the susceptibility really is how we take care of ourselves, and in thinking that we have responsibility. And I think as naturopathic doctors, you know, the tendency for us is to educate our patients and show them that it really takes requisite variety. It really takes, you know, thinking about your environment, using great foods, thinking about the love in your life, the kindness that you have around you, your happiness with what you do, you know, the joy to live, thinking about using simple things like herbs and, you know, just really, really using everything around you. And that's what contributes to health. I think when I see people who tell me about the genetics in their family and how afraid they are that they're definitely going to get cancer, for example, or definitely going to get this other terrible disease as a death sentence, I think that we shouldn't focus on that. I think we should more say, you know what, hey, maybe these are some of my susceptibilities, but I have the power to utilize so much ancient knowledge to help to heal and break the cycle of illness that has come upon my family through what in homeopathy we would consider a miasm, which is something that's passed on in generations and is very, very deep, causing chronic illnesses that are very, very serious in nature.
Yeah, and we've seen homeopathy really work pretty well through history, because we really can't argue about, you know, some of the amazing plagues that homeopathy has helped with, like the great cholera plagues in Europe and in America, when the homeopaths were given the ability to treat these patients. Because remember, back then, most homeopaths were medical doctors. So the allopathic physicians couldn't disparage them for lack of training, because they were they were often their very colleagues that went to school with them. But they just decided to practice homeopathy because they saw powerful efficacy. So a lot of those patients with the cholera, they were given camphora and other remedies. They got better, and I think statistically it was upwards of 70-80%, whereas the allopaths were only helping 10-20% at maximum through leaching and doing some of the things that using mercury and some of the other things that they're doing. Now they're just using the medications, though. But you mentioned the fact that homeopathy is an energy medicine, so that means that the way I understand it is you kind of have to know about physics instead of chemistry, and I think that's where medical doctors that really aren't thinking like biophysicists, they're thinking more like biochemists and not biophysicists, are not really understanding what's happening with homeopathy. So tell us a little bit about, you know, your thoughts on energy medicine and what could be happening when we either make a homeopathic remedy by shaking and diluting it, or what could be happening, and is there any research looking at that?
That's a great question, and I know that Dr. Montpellier, but essentially he's done a lot of research. He actually won the Nobel Prize really decided to go into his work thinking about homeopathy and how to prove it from that point of view. But when I think of homeopathy, I really think of it almost, and I keep mentioning the word vaccine, but what I think of is that you give a small dose of a toxic substance that actually is smaller than a material dose and is actually less than Avogadro's number, which is really the sign of what would be any form of material dose. But what does that do? What that does is it shakes the vitality of the person just enough so that the person could actually heal their own body. So the idea is to allow the person to heal from within and not have a substance act upon them, but allow the substance to help their bodies rejuvenate.
Yeah. And so some folks feel that it works through like harmonics, like an opera singer breaking a glass, shattering it with her voice, and it has to do with resonance, like the frequencies have to resonate. In other words, when you choose a homeopathic remedy for a patient, it has to match them. It has to match what's going on with them. So there's some kind of matching with the totality of the patient's symptomology, and I guess you can convert that to their energetics, because everything in physics, everything in the universe has a resonant frequency. So it's matching that with kind of the frequency of the remedy, which, like
Absolutely.
You said, it shakes, it allows their body's immune system and other what I call the greater defensive system, which involves, all the forces of the body that thwart disease and bring about homeostasis to work. It's just, it's amazing when we see it work. Tell us about some interesting cases that you've had where these folks have been very ill and have responded to homeopathy. You have a lot of great cases.
Oh, yeah, I can give you some. But I should tell you that the name was Luc Montagnier. He was the Nobel Prize winner.
Montagnier, thank you so much, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I can tell you quite a few
cases. There's a lot of biophysicists that are doing research on homeopathy now and looking at what might be going on with water and how water is realigning itself and transferring that energy into the patient, like a battery almost. It's like a living kind of battery. And if you get the wrong remedy, it doesn't do anything to help the person. That's a good thing, because there's no side effects, right? But if you get the right remedy, a lot of things can happen. So tell us a little bit about some cases and how you decided on the dose. And then eventually, we'll move into talking about your recent projects and a seminar that you're going to be running or that you're going to help organizing for April of 2017.
Sure, absolutely. So I guess, you know, like it's kind of a rainy day, and so the first case that comes to my mind is a woman who came to my office on a rainy day, and she was quite ill. She was taking tons of medication for her lupus. She had been on all sorts of steroids, and she was ANA positive, and she was young and really, really terrified because she had gained, you know, so much weight, and she had, you know, the classic butterfly rash on her face, you know, which is indicative of lupus, and she had joint pain. And, you know, you think of this and you think, okay, you know, this is an overwhelming case. And this was quite at the beginning of my practice, and I was going to leave to India in 2 days. And at the time, she said, you know, can you see me? And I said, well, I'll be back in, you know, 4 months. But I said, I'll take your case and I'll give you a remedy and, you know, we can see what happens. Because with homeopathy, what's beautiful is that, you know, they're kind of like wings that you can fly with for a little bit, and you don't necessarily need appointments every day or every week. So I told, okay, let's do this. And I remember looking at her and thinking, oh, she's so sick. And I had never seen someone with lupus before. So I just, you know, asked her, and I wanted to know what happened. And she didn't tell me about her lupus on that day. She told me about her dad. Dad was a heroin addict. She was his caregiver. She didn't know he was a heroin addict until he was dying of cancer, and found out, and traveled to see him and take care of him, and kind of, you know, it kindled a lot of pain in her. She, you know, was there for him throughout his whole process of dying, and he died. And she described washing him and how her hands, you know, would slowly get these rashes and her face would get these rashes and the pain in her joints and her elbows and her hands and her knees as she was caring for her father. Mm. And, you know, previously she had gotten vaccinated. She went to an Indian reservation and she got vaccinated for the HPV virus. So that kind of complicated things in my mind. But she kept talking about her father and how that grief just really was when everything started to flare.
So in other words, like she could point to a, you know, point in time and say, boy, since then I have been, like that was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Right, it's kind of like that little boy who was transferred by the window, where he was getting better, but then all of a sudden the window was open and cold wind hit him, and that solved the case. And then here, she was grief-stricken with her father, and boom, that's when the pain appeared. That's when the rashes came up, and that's when lupus really started for her. Mm-hmm. And so immediately, I thought of the one remedy that's paramount for grief, and it's Ignatia. And it's taken, and it's a bean, it's the Ignatius bean, and it's actually a powerful bean because this bean has been used in the Philippines for combating the plague, where the indigenous would literally wear the bean on their neck and would literally not get the plague because of the properties of this bean. And it also has a lot of strychnine in it. So it's quite toxic. It's quite potent. Nonetheless, it's dubbed the name Ignatius because it parallels with helping so many people with grief. So I gave her Ignatius. And when I gave her Ignatius, I gave her a very high potency. I gave her a 10M, which is a large potency, but not only did I give it,
in one dose, which is the classical Western homeopathic style, you know, one dose of a remedy and then you wait and watch for a month. And maybe we'll have time to talk about Indian versus Western homeopathy.
Yeah, yep.
But nonetheless, at the time I was leaving to India, so I was empowered with Indian philosophy, and I have my mentor who I still communicate with who's in India. And I said, okay, take the homeopathic medicine 2 to 3 times a day. This is a remedy that's usually used once a month, and I gave it to this woman to take 2 to 3 times a day. So I'm in India, and I'm thinking, great, I did a good job. And once I get to India, I tell my mentor, I said, oh, I gave this woman with lupus 10 mg 3 times a day. And his jaw dropped, and he said, oh, maybe that was too much. Maybe you should have started with a 200. 10 mg is very high. And I'm in India, and I don't have internet, and I'm having a heart attack.
So,
throughout the 4 months, I'm thinking about this poor thing. And when I get back to the States, I get a call. And she's off all of her medications. And her lupus no longer is present with any symptoms. But one curious thing happened. And I said, what's that curious thing? And she said, well, I had asthma all my life. And I no longer am suffering from asthma. Could that have been the remedy? And the whole time, she didn't talk about her father. And then I asked her about her dad. And she said, you know, it's like this beautiful piece where I kind of let go of it. Mm-hmm. And it was such a beautiful testament where she has her father in her heart, but she let go of the pain in a way that was debilitating her and eating her alive, as does lupus.
So this medicine seemed to have effects on the physical and the mental and emotional levels of people's existence then.
And that's the idea. The idea is that the remedies aren't just one aspect of a person. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have a cough, let me heal your cough. And in fact, if a remedy only heals a cough, then you're a little bit upset with the remedy on some level because you would like it to heal everything. A great example with this would be that in many different diseases, there's usually a change in the mental sphere of the person that can create anxiety or could create anger. And I'll give you an example, because you asked me to give you a few cases, and
sure.
I'll give you another one of
my
cases.
Well, maybe one more, and then we could talk about your thing.
Absolutely.
In India and your seminar, because we're looking at about 20 minutes more in the program, or a little less.
Oh, my. So essentially, this one, I believe I wrote up in the Huffington Post, if you check on my website. But essentially, I was with a man, and he had experienced severe pain. He had some herniated discs that he had for 14 years. He was on Vicodin, OxyContin, and Neurontin for 14 years. And he was in so much pain. And what happened was I started to ask about his history. And he told me his history was that his father was an alcoholic. His mother dealt with a lot of abuse. And I asked him, what happened? How did you respond to that abuse? And this is so interesting because here he came for pain, and I'm asking him all these in-depth questions about his history. He had x-rays. He had MRIs to show me. And those were all so important to me, and I still looked at those, but I wanted to know about his childhood. And he told me, well, when I was suffering, when I would see my mom like that, all I wanted to do was leave the house. I wanted to leave the house. And when I was out and moving, I was better. And I said, okay, when do you feel the pain the worst? And he goes, I always feel the pain. And I said, the worst. And he said, well, I hate my job. They stress me out. I am an editor, and it's at the last minute, and I'm getting yelled at, and I have to do at the very second the edits. But the second I get up from my chair and I move, I'm in a little bit less pain. And there's a remedy called Rhus toxodendron, which is poison ivy. And curiously, in the proving, the person felt better with movement. Movement being leaving the scene, movement being moving your legs. And this person, after being in pain for 14 years, within 4 hours of taking the homeopathic remedy, has never taken another painkiller again to this date, and it's been 3 years. So it's a beautiful case. But at the same time, it goes to show that when I spoke to him, we did so much more. And recently, I saw him again for other small things that go on as, you know, human beings. You know, we just end up having things going on. And he said, you know, Dr. Lopez, after you spoke to me that day, I started to walk and watch the sunrise no matter what, every single day. And I started to experience fun and changing my life and my environment and doing the things I love that could make me feel freer. And that's been a part of my healing too, including the diet, including the acupuncture treatments, including so much of the requisite variety of things that create holistic medicine.
Wow. Beautiful story.
And that's... It's a beautiful story, and then I'll give you a short one while in India.
Yeah, tell us about, give us some background a little bit for those that don't know about that you ended up studying with a very gifted homeopath, Robert Street, who has been in India working at a clinic for a very long time.
Oh, yeah, so Robert Street has been in practice for, I'd say, 40 maybe, I mean, since the 70s, you know, he's been practicing homeopathy, and he's seen over 50,000 cases of homeopathy exclusively for free. So his clinic is free, and it's in India, and it's at the Mayor Bhava Clinic Dispensary. All remedies are given for free. And he learned from his mentors, which were really, really beautiful, you know, homeopaths, and he learned from the real, real masters. I mean, from Kopi Kaur to, this is countless.
In India, there are hundreds of homeopathic hospitals and colleges that train physicians. It's very different from the climate here, where in order to learn homeopathy, you have to go to naturopathic school, or you could learn through some other ways, but it's very difficult here to learn the art of homeopathy, whereas in India, it's still a revered part of the healthcare plan.
It is revered, and it's actually considered a form of medical school. So instead of going to medical school, they can choose to go to homeopathic medical school, where they essentially take all of your, you know, your biochemistry courses, your anatomy, your physiology, your pathology courses, and then they do homeopathy. And they are so, I mean, it's just such a different perspective. Right. And homeopathy is so respected. And the cases that I saw, because there's such a respect, the breadth of research, the breadth of practitioners in communication with each other, the journals, the Indian homeopathic journals are phenomenal. And there's just so much that has been added.
And tons of real cases where doctors who are, you know,
beautiful,
more skeptical in the United States could look at some of these cases, go, you know, look at the chart notes, look at the before and after photos. That's what blew me away when I met Dr. Street, and he came and he lectured at my class and showed some of his you know, results speak. I don't care. You know, when you see someone getting better and you see a tumor shrinking from someone's neck, you know it's not trick photography. And it's just amazing.
Yeah.
So, that was what kind of drew me into, because, you know, you can, medicine's full of theories and a lot of fluff and things like that, but results are results, you know?
And that's really what's been consistent. You know, I work in the Bronx, and it's, you know, in the Bronx, people are tough. And if they don't get better, they leave. And you can't say, well, mentally you're better. No, it doesn't work. I want my pain to go away.
Right.
I want my symptom to be better. You know, if I spend my good, hard-earned money, then I want to make sure that it's for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I work with. You know, I'm a very practical person. And I just remember being in India and, you know, Robert Street had a case with avascular necrosis of the femur, where basically the femur is rotting. And that's, you know, right, you know, that the leg bone, I guess you would say. But, you know, essentially they wanted to cut this person's leg off. And, you know, interestingly enough, with a necrotic femur, he was moving his leg around. He couldn't stop moving his leg around. And that's a symptom of Lustox, which we spoke about. And
wow.
A very high potency, a few times daily, completely cured the necrotic femur. No other remedy, no herb, no change in diet. Granted, the Indian population is eating a lot better than we are.
He's seeing 50 patients a day, 100 patients a day coming to the clinic.
Oh, yeah. And it's much different than in the States. You know, there's, you know, we look at more of Bogenhausen, who is a homeopath who essentially used, you know, very straight keynote symptoms, peculiar symptoms and keynotes versus going through, you know, the whole life story of someone. So, you know, depending who I see, you know, I really vary my style of questioning.
Right.
I really vary, you know, my approach. And it's really a gift. And, you know, sometimes it's a really mental case. And that's seen a lot in the West.
Now, with
and
cancer,
you have to spend a
with
really
cancer,
long-
I don't want to cut you off, but we want to make sure we talk about your seminar, or else you'll be mad at me. So, now, you've met, in your other journeys, you've met other masters of homeopathy. So tell us about the master that you're going to be bringing to the New York metropolitan area.
Well, Dr. A.U. Ramakrishnan, he's written a book, A Homeopathic Approach to Cancer, and he has seen thousands of cases of cancer. And he practiced with Marjorie Blackie at the Royal Hahnemann Hospital in England. And Marjorie Blackie was the homeopath to the Queen of England. So this is amazing, amazing roots of knowledge. And he can actually trace himself back to Hahnemann, which is kind of fun because now him being one of my teachers, I can trace myself back to Hahnemann, you know. So it's super cool. But the principle is that he treats cancer as an acute illness, kind of like a flu or something that is acute but isn't the general constitution of a person. So he'll give an acute remedy based on the presentation and the peculiar symptoms of the cancer. And then he'll give the constitutional remedy if needed. And it's been really, really beautiful. And, you know, he's been bringing, he has about a 5-year, he follows up with his patients for 5 years. And so he'll see, and he's had quite an interesting success. He claims an 86% remission rate in metastatic breast cancer, which is remarkable. And he has quite a number of interesting successes with pancreatic cancer using one of the notable homeopathic remedies. He uses ceonanthus, which is red root, which is also New Jersey tea. It's a homeopathic remedy, very, very, very much important for the spleen, but also the pancreas. And that was actually really studied by James Compton Burnett, who happened to be Marjorie Blackie's uncle.
Wow.
So there's some real lineage there and roots there towards the understanding of these remedies. And James Compton Burnett really looked at organ remedies, and he thought about how specific homeopathic remedies could actually be tailored to specific organs. But at the same time, it's never so easy. It's never heart and give heart remedy as the allopaths do. There's still this art about it, and there's still this understanding of the mechanisms intertwined with the organopathy. So he tends to look at the organ that's kind of been engrossed by cancer and the organ that's involved in the homeopathic remedies that are really successful and useful for those organs. And so well,
he's seen many patients as a homeopathic oncologist. And I know he talks about that, you know, people are followed by a regular oncologist, so people can look at the x-rays, the lab tests, the kind of Western parameters, which measure the success or, prognosis of the patient.
Absolutely. And he tends to tell the patient to get the tumor removed, and he then goes for cleansing.
And then he tries to do a remedy based on many of those factors that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So he's
actually coming here to
yes.
in New York?
He will be in New York City, and I'm going to be bringing him, and let me get the date. Oh, my. I'm going to be bringing him.
I know it's in April sometime.
Yeah, it's April 23rd, and I'll be hosting him and Dr. Street from 9 to 1 at the Taller Latino, which is on 99th Street between 1st and 2nd. That's T-A-L-L-E-R Latino, but it's a small space, so I want to make sure that I get any email confirmations, you know, if anyone wants to come, and it's by donation. And, I really wanted to make the event by donation because I want to honor the fact that I was taught by my mentors without fees and without having to pay, and I honor that so much that I'd like to extend and create a space where people can learn from someone who, from two very, very important healers of homeopathy. And I'm creating an event called Conversations Without Elders, and it's actually the kickoff of the event Conversations with Our Elder Healers. So I'm presenting Robert Street and Dr. A. Ramakrishnan as the first to talk, and maybe we'll be inviting you soon, Dr. Z, to lead our conversations as well. And see. But it would be wonderful because I think it's important that we really educate our healers around us and share, especially with our grandmothers and grandfathers of medicine. I think that there's a sad loss to the ingenuity and to the art and to the respect. And as you said in the beginning, you know, the onset of our conversation was all about doing things and really getting our hands dirty. And I think that to be a healer, we have to get our hands dirty. We have to do the fast. We have to taste the medicines. We have to go under homeopathic treatment. You know, we have to go out and wild pick our foods. I mean, I remember just recently going with my husband and picking tons and tons of acorns to make our acorn pancakes and thinking about all of the delicious fats that we're not getting, you know, that people aren't getting when they don't have acorns in their diet. And
How'd they come out? Pretty good?
And then also thinking about how many tannins, you know, we have to take out of the acorns to actually make them usable.
So now if folks want to come to this webinar, do they have to be physicians or is it open to lay people? What's the deal with that?
It's open to healers. Because
okay, so any type of healer.
Any type of healer, as long as, you know, homeopathy is an interest of yours, it would be wonderful. And I would appreciate just an email at drkarinalopez@gmail.com, and you just spell out doctor, DrKarinaLopez as in zebra, @gmail.com to RSVP. And it's by donation. So, you know, it's just a way for us to give back and to create more events like these and, you know, reserve space.
Boy, that sounds great. hear the music. So I guess it's time for us to sign off. So thank you for this very interesting discussion on homeopathy. And we'll invite you back on to talk more about it. Okay, and that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We want you to stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye till we meet again.